Healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
Portland, it's an exciting day. Queer world, there's no queer world with Jack today. Jack is snowed in, so we're throwing on Loretta Napoleone on Terror Economics from the Women's International News Service. 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Lisa at 10. I'm coming back with my friend R.V. Branham of the Gobshite Quarterly. They'll discuss the next issue of this international literary magazine, which is a real hoot. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard's guest is Stephanie Snyder, curator of the Cooley Gallery at Reed College, discussing the gallery's current show featuring the work of British mixed media and performance artist Mona Hatoum. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, the U.S. training death squads to fight the U.S. training death squads to fight the Iraqi insurgency. So stay tuned.
Osama bin Laden is a charismatic leader, is very much, I would say, you know, the equivalent of, you know, Stalin or Lenin or that kind of ideological status. One of the danger of killing Osama bin Laden is actually to turn him into an icon much, much bigger than what he is today. And yes, he is the most important. There's nobody else at that level in the world.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today on Wings, part two of a talk by Italian economist Loretta Napoleone, author of Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks.
Okay. The question is about the importance that unemployment plays for recruitment of Islamic terrorist organization and what is the concept of the shell state. Let me start with the concept of the shell state because that's very central to my book. When I was talking about the privatization of terrorism, I was mentioning the PLO. Now, the way the PLO actually managed to become independent is by creating what I define as shell state. Now, shell state is a state only as the outside of a state, the socio-economic infrastructure of a state, but it lacks the core of the state, which is the national identity. In the case of the PLO, when it was in Lebanon, it actually managed to control the entire economy of Lebanon. And this is the primary reason why Israel invaded Lebanon. The reason why the shell state is so successful is because it actually takes shape in highly destabilized political areas. A good example of shell states now taking place is actually Iraq. By destabilizing the political situation in Iraq, we're now seeing Islamic groups moving into various areas and gaining control of these areas. Now, a shell state can be as small as a section of a town. I mean, during the civil war in Lebanon, the Christian militia controlled East Lebanon, which was the enclave where the Christians lived, and he basically ran that enclave like a state. I mean, he was in charge of taxation and cleaning the streets. So that's quite dangerous, because these shell states, what they do, they basically destroy the socio-economic infrastructure of the regions or areas that they control militarily. Again, Iraq is a good example. Lots of people have asked, why are they attacking the Red Cross and why are they attacking the UN delegation? Now, that was not the first time that something like this happened. It happened in Chechnya, it happened in Africa, it happened in Bosnia. It's part of their strategy. By destroying the socio-economic infrastructure of the areas they control, they force the population to become dependent upon their economy. So one way or another, the population is drawn to the armed organization. That doesn't mean that they have to join the armed organization. They actually start working for the infrastructure around the armed organization. So the shell state, of course, is attractive to unemployed people. In my book, I talk about the Central Asian Republics. There is a region called the Fergana Valley, which is should be an extremely fertile region, but is a region with 80% unemployment. That's one of the best grounds for recruitment for Islamic terrorist groups. They have nothing else. I mean, that's the only way they can actually feed themselves, feed their family, and even, you know, have a vision of a better life in the long term. Yes, the CIA use techniques which are very similar during the state sponsor of terrorism in order to create an economic situation whereby the local population actually support the armed organization that they were backing. Now, the Contras is a very good example in Honduras and in Guatemala, because, you know, the spreading actually of the Contras in the neighboring countries of Nicaragua created economic decay in these regions. And people were forced. Yes, but yes, you're right. Okay, the question is that the dependency of the American economy upon this terror economy is so big. You don't have to think that this was created by Western capitalism. This is something that happened because Western capitalism was so greedy that decided to knock down barriers without thinking about the consequences of these barriers coming down. I mean, offshore banking is fantastic for Western capitalism, but it's also very good for anybody that wants to move money around without being phoned. And this is what these guys are doing. From the point of view of the U.S. economy, it is true that the U.S. is actually benefiting in economic terms from this economy. Now, what I do not think that this administration has realized yet is that, and that includes also the Fed and Greenspan, is that this economy is not only illegal and criminal economy, it's also a terror economy. But if you look at the U.S. money supply, M1, which is cash and ready deposit, Since the 1960s, there has been a trend in the U.S. whereby more and more money, which are produced, the new stock of dollars, which is produced every year, leaves the United States and never comes back. Now, there have been a lot of economists who have written about that, including people from the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, saying this is a serious problem. Where are this money going? This money are going to feed the illegal economy. Now, nothing has been done. Now, today, the total amount of M1 is $500 billion. Of this $500 billion, two-thirds leaves the United States and never comes back. These are money that leave in suitcases, that leave through offshore banking. These are not money that are actually leaving because they go into the reserves of foreign banks. Now, these are money that actually go and feed the international illegal economy, which is, as I said before, denominated in U.S. dollar. Now, for the United States, it's a net saving because, of course, the Treasury every year can borrow against $500 billion. The truth is that the amount of the money supply in the U.S. is only one-third. So now this can happen only because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world, so it has a special status. But nevertheless, the Americans are actually borrowing money thanks to the growth of the illegal and terror economy. There are a lot of conspiracy theories. Shall I repeat the question? The question is that the links between Osama bin Laden and the CIA, that actually Osama bin Laden is a creation of the CIA, and that the Bush administration did not do anything or even stopped the investigation on Al-Qaeda. Okay, let me answer. You can sit down now. I'll answer this. I did this research and I never came across anything that links directly the CIA to Osama bin Laden. Now, the CIA, together with the Saudi, they funded the anti-Soviet jihad. They set up the Afghan pipeline, which was a system through which cash and weapons went to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan who were fighting the Soviets. There was $5 billion going through that pipeline, and very little of those $5 billion reached the Mujahideen because it was widespread bribery, stealing by everybody along the pipeline, including... You can sit down. I have to finish. Yes, okay. Now, what Osama bin Laden did at that time while he was in Afghanistan was actually to set up an alternative system of funding for the Mujahideen because of this problem with the Afghan pipeline. So this is when the charities became particularly active, because he actually used funding from donation, primarily from Saudi Arabia, in order to fund the Mujahideen. Now, according to my research, Osama bin Laden was never trained by the CIA. In fact, Osama bin Laden was never trained at all, because he's not a fighter. He was actually somebody who was looking after the financial side of the Mujahideen. Let me finish. And then, it is true that the FBI, before 9/11, was investigating a charity called WAMI. Now, WAMI was a charity that was run in the United States by two brothers of Osama bin Laden. It's an incredibly rich charity from Saudi Arabia. It's called the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. It's active in 35 countries. It has been put on trial in the Philippines and in India in the late 1990s, and this is why the FBI started investigating it here. Now, the Clinton administration told the FBI to go slowly on that investigation because of the links between this organization and key figures in Saudi Arabia. When Bush came to power, he actually told the FBI to back off. So that investigation was never actually completed. So it is true that there was no interest in investigating certain funding of Islamic terrorist groups before 9/11, but this is because this was a phenomenon that did not affect the United States directly, as I said before in my speech. But if you ask me about conspiracy theory, I do not believe them. Well, no, excuse me. There are other people. This is the public. It's a public. You had your chance. Please, I have absolutely no documentation in my hands that Osama bin Laden is a CIA agent. So if you do have documents, I'll be very happy to look at them. Yeah, the question is about small arms. Now, small arms are different from conventional arms. They're generally arms that are used in guerrilla warfare. The shoulder missiles, for example, which they're using now in Iraq, to knock down helicopters is considered small arm. Missiles, on the other hand, and tanks is conventional arms. Now, the arms organization only buys small arms. I mean, first of all, because they have no access to conventional arms. Conventional arms are sold by states. The United States is the largest producer of both conventional arms and small arms. And the majority, actually, of the weapons, which are bought illegally by armed organization or mafia organization and organized crimes, comes from the United States. Canada does participate in this export. So does France. But the second largest producer of small arms is Russia. Africa and Southeast Asia is actually predominantly supplied by Russia. I mean, if you want me to comment on the moral argument, I can't because I'm an economist. But the truth is that this is a world where everything is sold and everything can be bought. And this is not different from the world 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. What can the citizen of Canada do about this involvement? Well, there's a lot that people can actually do to convince the politicians to pass legislation to prevent the sales of these arms. You want figures about how much money are going into the reconstruction in Iraq? No, I don't have the figures because there is no reconstruction yet. The $87 billion additional budget, which has been voted by Congress, is going totally to sustain the war in one way or another. But what is more shocking is that 30% of that budget, more than 30% actually, $13 billion of that budget is actually going to the private military industry. Now, there are 10,000 mercenaries in Iraq from the United States. The second largest contingency of the coalition forces are mercenaries. The British are only 9,000. So the U.S. military industry has been privatized in the last 10 years. There's very little that the U.S. government is still supplying directly, apart from training of soldiers, from the shoes to the tanks. Everything comes from the private industry. So I think that's even more interesting than the reconstruction because, we talk a lot about, who is actually getting the money for this reconstruction, which, again, has not been taken place yet. I mean, there are various bids and various decisions have been taken, but, nobody's actually started rebuilding schools yet. But more interesting, I think, is the fact that the private industry, which is the U.S. private industry, is actually sustaining the actual war. I mean, it's not the U.S. military, but it's the mercenaries of the U.S. I think that's very serious. The question is about the BCCI. The BCCI actually was a Pakistani registered bank, but it was fully funded by the Saudis. It was the largest international bank from the Third World, and when it fell, it was a major financial scandal. I have it in my book, actually, it's a chapter about the Islamic financial colonization, and that describes the birth of Islamic banks. Now, Islamic banks were actually created in the late 1970s. After the first oil shock, there was a massive amount of money which flew from West to oil-producing countries, in particular in Saudi Arabia. I mean, a lot of this money came back to the West, to the so-called recycling of petrodollars. Basically, Western banks went to the Saudis and said, I can invest your money in the West, which is better than keeping there in the middle of the desert. So the money actually came back. But a lot of money stayed in Saudi Arabia. They were invested in Saudi Arabia and created the economic boom of Saudi Arabia. Now, a group of bankers from Saudi Arabia, some of them linked to the Bin Laden family. In fact, one, Bin Malfous, is one of Bin Laden's brother-in-law. They decided to set up Islamic banks. And now, for Islamic religion, the interest rate is actually a sin. You're not supposed to charge money for money. Basically, it is usury. So therefore, they were quite concerned about the presence of Western banks in their country. And this dates back to the 1960s, actually, even 50s in Egypt. So they used this money that were coming from the recycling petrodollar to set up these banks. The actual structure of the Islamic bank was written by the clerics, by the Wahhabis. So the Islamic banks, for example, incorporate the zakat, which is the religious almsgiving that every single Muslim has to give. And it's equivalent to 2.5% of its wealth. So every single time that a transaction takes place and somebody makes money, the bank will levy the zakat. Now, the first most successful Islamic bank was BCCI. And BCCI then became a sort of flag for all the other banks. Now, BCCI was incredibly well connected. It was the bank used by the CIA to funnel money through the Afghan pipeline during the anti-Soviet jihad. It's a bank that's been used by George W. Bush several times for his Arbusto company and Arkin company, for example. So we're talking about an extremely well-connected bank. And now, it was also a bank run by a bunch of crooks, of course. And this is why eventually it collapsed. But the important thing is that the BCCI, it is the blueprint of Islamic banks today, actually used by Islamic terrorist groups in order to move money from one place to another. And that's very important, because the difference between a terrorist organization and a criminal organization is that the criminal organization ultimate goal is accumulation of wealth. The ultimate goal of a terrorist organization is not the accumulation, but the distribution of wealth. How are you going to move money from one country to another country? How are you going to move money from one cell to another cell? And this is where Islamic banks actually play a very important role. The question is, the U.S. administration is interested in stopping the funneling of money. Yes, the U.S. administration is interested in stopping the funneling of money, but it can't do anything because the money are not in the West. The majority of the money are actually in the Muslim world, and we have no jurisdiction that over there. Now, the UN has just produced a document which came out at the beginning of December. In this document, the UN says that so far only $125 million have been frozen of terror money, which is absolutely nothing. Of this $125 million, only $54 million are money that went directly to Al-Qaeda. Now, the 70% of this money has been frozen in the West. 30% has been frozen in the East. The reason why we cannot get into this money is because we have no jurisdiction over the countries where actually the money are generated. And I think this is a very serious problem, because that means that the U.S. administration is relying more and more on its allies that we're talking about Saudi Arabia, for example. And Saudi Arabia is in a very dangerous position because he can't go after the money of Islamic group, he can't go after his own charities because the ruling elite is already extremely unpopular. So he has to balance between the American allies and its own internal social unrest. Okay, the question is about, how the U.S. was funding a terrorist network, some example. The U.S. was heavily involved during the Cold War in state-sponsored terrorism, funding groups to fight war by proxy. That doesn't mean that today the U.S. is not involved. I mean, a good example is Sudan. Actually, the U.S. is supporting the SPLA, which is a group which has occupied the southern part of Sudan. It's considered to be a sort of Christian group, but the truth is it is a terrorist group. When the U.S. is funding them not only with cash but also with weapons, and the reason why it's doing that is because the northern part of Sudan is under the control of a government which is pro-Islamist, although it's much less militant than it was before. So in a certain way, we're looking at another war by proxy. That's what generally the U.S. does. Okay, the IRA has always been considered the best organization for explosive. I mean, they are incredibly skilled to create bombs that will explode at the right time and in the right place. I mean, the bombing in Brighton of the hotel where Mrs. Thatcher was staying, the IRA actually put that bomb a month before, and they put the bomb underneath the bathtub and they program it with the video recorder. They are amazing. So they have been training people on explosives all over the world. They don't do it for ideological reasons. They actually do it for money to fund their struggle. So when this happened in Colombia, which is last year, the IRA officially was not operational anymore. However, the IRA has been funding the transition from a terrorist organization to a political organization, which is Sinn Féin, through the same activities, illegal activities that they have been selling for years. And this is a good example of how difficult is actually the transition from the illegal economy into the legal economy, because this organization has been run in a certain way for a very long time, and they don't know any other way to raise money. So, okay, the question is about the drug trade and how this drug trade is linked to the terror economy. In my calculation, the new economy of terror, which is the international economic system generated by armed organization activities, is equivalent to $500 billion. Of this $500 billion, one-third is legal activities, and the remaining is illegal activities. Of this, the largest entry is actually coming from drugs. Now, the total amount of drug trade around the world, illegal drugs, of course, we're talking, is $500 billion. This includes, of course, the amount of money that the mafia or that criminal organization gets. But I would say that easily $300 billion is actually what the terror organization gets. There are two major areas where illegal drugs are produced. One is Central Asia. Afghanistan produces 80% of the opium of the entire world. And the other area is South America. Now, in South America, we see the FARC, which is the former Marxist terrorist group, now has become a sort of militia for the narco-traffickers. We also see Sendero Luminoso, the other Marxist terrorist group, from Peru is actually overlooking the production of coca in Peru and also being in charge of selling it to the various drug dealers that then, you know, sell it to North America. So they get a very large percentage of that business. And if you look at the drug route, the majority of the passages from, you know, one country to another is handled by terrorist organization. The only time where you get the mafia involved is actually when the drugs arrive almost at the gate of Europe, which is Turkey. And then from Turkey onwards, you have a mixture of terror organization and mafia. So this is why I said that of these 400 billion, about 300 is actually goes into the new economy of terror. Well, Enron was not involved with drug laundering of money. I mean, you know, I don't think, I didn't come across Enron in my research. Sorry. Yeah, okay, but I can only comment on what I research. I'm a human being and I have limitations. The only forecast I did, if two-thirds of the U.S. money supply actually goes into this economy as new stock of cash every year, that means that this economy is growing twice as fast as the U.S. economy. And that's quite scary. Yeah, the money supply is that every year the Fed produces new stock of dollars, okay? This new stock of dollars is based upon the need of the economy. The need of the economy, and this country, for example, every year produces a new stock of Canadian dollars. I don't know the exact figure, but those Canadian dollars are used by every single Canadian in this country in order to buy things, right? So in the case of the United States, that figure should not be 500 billion. It should be only one-third of those 500 billion. And what is happening is that the U.S. is also feeding another economy, a terror economy.
This concludes Wing's two-part series with Italian economist Loretta Napoleoni, author of Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Network. She spoke at the Vancouver Public Library in January 2004. For more information, email wings@wings.org or check the website www.wings.org. Our mailing address is Box 95090, Vancouver, BC, V5T48, Canada. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughan, author of Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And this is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Also, Portland's gay and lesbian community yellow pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. Also, Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people, proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422. Here comes Press Watch.